Another fellow I'd never heard of, Waimun huffed. Well, that's not surprising. He moved to England many decades ago, but he is still, very quietly, one of the most influential figures in Asia. Waimun, you have to realize that before your generation of fat cats, there was an earlier generation of tycoons who made their fortunes and moved on to greener pastures. I thought most of the Youngs had long since dispersed from Singapore. The last time I heard any news, it was that one of the daughters had married into the Thai royal family. Sounds like a pretty well-connected bunch, Paiklin said. Oh, yes, indeed. The eldest daughter, for instance, is married to Harry Leong. Harry Leong, the fellow who is director of the Institute of ASEAN Affairs. That's just a title, Waimun. Harry Leong is one of the kingmakers in our government. No wonder I always see him in the Prime Minister's box at National Day celebrations. So this family is close to the center of power. Waimun, they are the center of power, Dr. Gu corrected, turning to Paiklin. You say your friend is dating the grandson? She's a fortunate girl, then, if she marries into this clan. I was beginning to think the same thing myself, Paiklin said quietly. Dr. Gu considered Paiklin thoughtfully for a moment, and then he peered straight into her eyes, saying, Remember, every treasure comes with a price. She caught his gaze for a moment before looking away. Dr. Gu, it's always good to see you. Thank you for all your help, Waimun said, getting up. He was starting to get a backache from the rickety wooden chair. And thank you for the wonderful tea, Paiklin said, helping Dr. Gu up from his seat. Will you ever accept my invitation and come over for dinner? I have a new cook who makes amazing Ipoh Ho Fan, Dr. Gu. You're not the only one who has a good cook, Go Waimun, Dr. Gu said wryly, walking them to their car. As Waimun and Paiklin merged into the early evening traffic on Dunyan Road, Waimun said, Why don't we invite Rachel and her boyfriend to dinner next week? Paiklin nodded. Let's take them somewhere classy, like Minjiang. Dr. Gu stood by his gate, watching as their car disappeared. The sun was setting just over the treetops, a few rays of light penetrating through the branches and glaring into his eyes. He awoke with a start in the blinding sun to find his bleeding wrists bound tightly against the rusty chain-link fence. A group of officers walked by, and he noticed one uniformed man staring at him intently. Did he look familiar somehow? The man went up to the commanding officer and pointed directly at him. Curse to the gods! This was it. He looked at them, trying to muster up as much hate as he could in his expression. He wanted to die defiant, with pride. The man said calmly in a British-accented English, There's been a mistake. That one over there, in the middle, is just a poor idiot servant. I recognize him from my friend's farm, where he rears the pigs. One of the Japanese soldiers translated to the commanding officer, who sneered in disgust before barking out a few curt orders. He was cut loose and brought to kneel in front of the soldiers. Through his bleary eyes, he suddenly recognized the man who had pointed him out. It was Dr. Young, who had taught one of his surgical classes when he was a medical trainee. See, this is not a man of importance. He's not even worth your bullets. Let him go back to the farm where he can feed the dirty pigs, Dr. Young said, before walking off with the other soldiers. More arguing between the soldiers ensued, and before he knew what was happening, he found himself on a transport truck bound for the work farms in Geylang. Months later, he would run into Dr. Young at a meeting in the secret room hidden behind a shop house on Telok Ayer Street. He began thanking him profusely for saving his life, but Dr. Young brushed him off quickly. Nonsense. You would have done the same for me. Besides, I couldn't let them kill yet another doctor. There are too few of us left, he said plainly. As Dr. Gu walked slowly back into his house, he felt a sudden pang of regret. He wished he hadn't said so much about the Youngs. Waimun, as usual, had steered him toward the stories about money, and he had missed the chance to tell them the real story about a man whose greatness had nothing to do with wealth or power. Chapter 17. Rachel, Singapore.
I've been trying to reach you for days. Where have you been? Do you get all the messages I left at the hotel?
Carrie asked her daughter in rapid-fire Mandarin. Mom, I'm sorry. I was away all weekend and only just got back, Rachel replied, raising her voice as she always did whenever she was talking to anyone long distance, even though she could hear her mother perfectly well.
Where did you go?
I went to a remote island in the Indian Ocean for a bachelorette party.
Huh? You went to India?
Her mother asked, still confused. No, not India. It's an island in the Indian Ocean off the coast of Indonesia. It's an hour plane ride from Singapore.
You took a plane trip just for 2 days?
Hiya! What a waste of money.
Well, I wasn't paying, and besides, I flew on a private plane. You flew on a private plane? Whose plane?
The bride's. Wow, so lucky, Is the bride very rich?
Mom, these people, Rachel began before discreetly lowering her voice. Both the bride and groom come from very wealthy families.
Really? What about Nick's family? Are they rich too?
Carrie asked. How did she know this would be the next question out of her mom's mouth? Rachel glanced toward the bathroom. Nick was still in the shower, but she decided to step out of the room anyway. She walked into the garden toward the quiet, shadier side of the pool.
Yes, Mom. Nick comes from a wealthy family, Rachel said, sitting down on one of the lounge chairs by the pool. You know, this is something I suspected all along. He's so well brought up. I can tell just by looking at how he behaves during dinner. Such lovely manners. And he always offers me the best part of the meat, like the fish cheek or the juiciest piece of duck.
Well, it doesn't really matter, Mom, because it seems like everyone here is rich. I think I'm still in a bit of a culture shock, or maybe it's cash shock. The way these people spend money, the houses and the planes and the dozens of maids, you need to see it with your own eyes. It's as if the recession isn't happening here. Everything is ultra-modern and sparkling clean.
That's all I hear from friends who visit Singapore. That it's clean, too clean.
Carrie paused for a moment, her voice taking on a tone of concern.
Daughter, you need to watch out.
What do you mean, Mom?
I know how those families can be, and you don't want to give them the impression that you are after Nick's money. From now on, you need to be extra careful how you present yourself.
Too late for that, Rachel thought.
I'm just being myself, Mom. I'm not going to change how I behave.
She wanted so much to tell her mother about the dreadful weekend, but she knew it would only worry her needlessly. She had done the same thing with Nick, sharing only the vaguest details. Besides, they had spent most of the afternoon in a marathon lovemaking session, and she hadn't wanted to spoil their postcoital bliss with any horror stories.
Is Nick being good to you? Her mother asked.
Of course, Mom. Nick is a sweetheart, as always. He's just rather distracted right now with his friend's wedding coming up. It's going to be the biggest wedding Asia has ever seen, Mom. All the newspapers have been covering it.
Really? Should I get one of the Chinese newspapers when I go into San Francisco tomorrow?
Sure, you can try. The bride is Araminta Lee, and the groom is Colin Koo. Look out for their names.
What are Nick's parents like?
I don't know. I'm meeting them tonight.
You have been there for almost 1 week and you still haven't met his parents?
Carrie remarked, warning lights flashing in her head. They were out of the country last week, Mom, and then we were away this weekend.
So you are going to meet his parents today?
Yes, dinner at their house.
But why aren't you staying with them?
Carrie asked, her concern growing. There were so many little signs that her Americanized daughter did not understand.
Mom, stop overanalyzing this. Nick's friend owns the hotel, so we're staying here during the wedding period for the convenience. But we're moving to his grandmother's house next week.
Carrie didn't buy her daughter's explanation. In her mind, it still made no sense that the only son of a Chinese family would be staying in a hotel with his girlfriend instead of at his parents' house. Unless he was ashamed of Rachel. Or even worse, maybe the parents had forbidden him to bring her home.
What are you bringing to his parents? Did you get the Estee Lauder gifts like I told you to? No, I figured it would be too personal to give Nick's mom cosmetics without having even met her. There's a terrific florist in the hotel, and
no, daughter, never bring flowers, especially not those white ones you love.
White flowers are only for funerals. You should bring them a big basket of mandarin oranges and hand it to them with both hands. And make sure that you bow your head very deeply when you greet his mother and father for the first time. These are all gestures of respect.
I know, Mom. You're acting like I'm 5 years old.
Why are you suddenly getting so worried? This is the first time you have been serious with a Chinese man? There is so much you don't know about the proper etiquette with these families.
I didn't realize you could be so old-fashioned, Rachel teased. Besides, Nick's family doesn't seem really Chinese at all. They seem more British, if anything.
It doesn't matter. You are Chinese, and you still need to behave like a properly brought-up Chinese girl, Carrie said.
Don't worry, Mom. It's just dinner, Rachel said lightly, even though her anxiety was beginning to build.
Chapter 18. The Youngs. Singapore. With its prime position atop Conhill Road, the Residences at One Conhill was a striking marriage of architectural preservation and real estate wizardry. Originally the home of prominent banker Kar Chin Kee and built during the late Victorian period, the house had long been a landmark. But as land values skyrocketed over the decades, all the other big houses gave way to the developers and high-rise towers sprang up around the graceful mansion like overgrown bamboo. By the time the great man died in 2006, the house was deemed far too historic to tear down, yet far too valuable to remain a single residence. So Kar Chin Kee's heirs decided to preserve the original structure, converting it into the base of a sleek 30-story glass tower where Nick's parents now lived, when they were in Singapore, that is. As the taxi climbed the hill toward the imposing Corinthian column portico, Nick explained its history to Rachel.
Uncle Chin Kee was a friend of my grandmother's, so we used to visit every Chinese New Year, and I would be made to recite some elaborate poem in Mandarin. Then the old man who reeked of cigars would give me a hongbao. You know, those New Year red packets stuffed with $500.
That's insane, Rachel exclaimed. Isn't the hongbao just supposed to be a token of good luck for little children? The biggest hongbao I ever got in my life was $50, and that was from this asshole dating my mom who was really trying to win me over.
What did you do with all that money? Are you kidding? My parents kept it, of course.
They kept all my New Year money. I never saw a cent of it. Rachel looked at him in horror.
That's just wrong. Hongbaos are as sacred as Christmas presents. Don't get me started on what they did with my presents on Christmas morning.
Nick laughed. As they entered the elevator, Rachel inhaled deeply as she prepared to meet Nick's parents, these hongbao snatchers, for the first time.
Hey, don't forget to breathe, Nick said, massaging her shoulders gently.
On the 30th floor, the elevator opened directly into the penthouse's foyer, and they were greeted by an enormous pane of glass that framed a panoramic view of the Orchard Road shopping district.
Wow,
Rachel whispered, marveling at the deep purple dusk settling over the skyline. A woman appeared from around the corner and said,
"Aya, Nikki, why is your hair so long? You look like a ruffian. You better get it cut short before Colin's wedding."
"Hi, Mum," Nick said simply.
Rachel was still reeling from the abruptness of this encounter when Nick continued,
"Mum, I'd like you to meet Rachel Chu, my girlfriend."
"Oh, hello," Eleanor said, as if she had no idea who the girl might be.
"So this is the girl.
She looks better than in that school yearbook picture obtained by the detective." "It's so nice to meet you, Mrs. Young," Rachel found herself saying, although her mind was still trying to accept the notion that this woman could actually be Nick's mother. Rachel had been expecting an imperious grande dame with a powdered white face and a tight perm dressed in some Hillary Clinton-esque pantsuit, but before her stood a striking woman in a trendy scoop-neck top, black leggings, and ballet flats, looking far too young to have a 32-year-old son. Rachel bowed her head and presented her gift of oranges. How lovely. Yeah, you really shouldn't have, Eleanor replied graciously.
Why in the world did she bring mandarin oranges? Does she think it's Chinese New Year? And why is she bowing like some stupid Japanese geisha?
Have you been enjoying Singapore so far?
Yes, very much, Rachel replied. Nick's taken me to have the most fantastic hawker food.
Where did you take her? Eleanor looked at her son dubiously.
You're practically a tourist yourself. You don't know all the secret holes in the wall like I do.
We've been to Lau Pa Sat, Old Airport Road, Holland Village, Nick began.
A la muck! What is there to eat in Holland Village? Eleanor exclaimed.
Plenty. We had the best rojak for lunch, Nick said defensively.
Nonsense. Everyone knows that the only place to go for rojak is that stall on the top floor of Lucky Plaza.
Rachel laughed, her nerves quickly dissipating. Nick's mother was so funny. Why had she been so nervous?
Well, this is it, Eleanor said to her son, gesturing at the space.
I don't know what you were talking about, Mum. The place looks perfect.
A la muck. You don't know how much of a headache this flat has caused me. We had to restain the floors 6 times to get the right finish.
Nick and Rachel stared down at the beautiful, gleaming white oak floors.
And then some of the custom furniture in the guest bedrooms had to be redone, and the automatic blackout curtains in my bedroom aren't dark enough. I've had to sleep in one of the guest bedrooms on the other side of the flat for more than a month now because the curtains are on back order from France.
The entry foyer opened into a great room with 30-foot ceilings and a grid-like pattern of skylights that drenched the room with light. The space was made even more dramatic by a sunken oval pit in the center, with sleek Hermès orange sofas perfectly contoured around both sides of the oval. From the ceiling, a spiral chandelier of sculptured golden glass teardrops pirouetted down until it almost touched the oval driftwood coffee table. Rachel could hardly believe that Nick's parents lived in such a space. It looked more like the lobby of some impossibly hip hotel. A phone rang in another room, and a maid peered out of a doorway to announce, "It's Mrs. Fu and Mrs. Leung."
"Oh, Consuelo, please send them up," Eleanor said. "At last, the reinforcements are here."
Nick looked at his mother in surprise.
"You invited other people? I thought we were going to have a quiet family dinner."
Eleanor smiled. "We would have if it were just our family."
"It's only the regular crowd, La. The cook made laksa, and it's always better to have more people for that. Besides, everyone wants to see you, and they can't wait to meet Rachel."
Nick smiled at Rachel in an attempt to cover up his dismay. He had wanted his parents to give their undivided attention to Rachel, but his mother was always springing last-minute surprises like this.
"Go wake your father, Nick. He's napping in his media room down that hall," Eleanor instructed.
Nick and Rachel walked toward the media room. The sounds of gunfire and explosions could be heard from within. As they approached the open door, Rachel could see Nick's father asleep on a Danish ergonomic recliner while Battlestar Galactica played on the flat-screen television built into the sandblasted oak wall.
"Let's not disturb him,"
Rachel whispered, but Nick entered anyway.
"Wakey, wakey," he said softly.
Nick's father opened his eyes and looked up at Nick in surprise.
"Oh, hello? Is it dinner time?"
"Yes, Dad." Nick's father got up from the chair and looked around, spotting Rachel standing shyly in the doorway.
"You must be Rachel Chu," he said, smoothing down the back of his hair.
"Yes," Rachel replied, coming into the room. Nick's father extended his hand.
"Philip Young,"
he said with a smile, shaking her hand firmly. Rachel liked him instantly, and she could at last see where her boyfriend got his looks. Nick's large eyes and elegantly shaped mouth were exactly like his mother's, but the thin nose, prominent jawline, and thick jet black hair were unmistakably his father's.
"When did you get in?"
Nick asked his father.
"I caught the morning flight from Sydney. I wasn't planning to come until later in the week, but your mum insisted that I fly up today."
"Do you work in Sydney, Mr. Young?" Rachel asked.
"Work? No, I moved to Sydney not to work. It's far too beautiful a place for work. You get distracted by the weather and the sea, the long walks and the good fishing."
"Oh, I see," Rachel said. She noticed that his accent was a unique fusion of British, Chinese, and Australian. Just then, there was a knock on the door, and Astrid peeked in.
I'm under strict orders to corral all of you, she announced.
Astrid, I didn't know you were coming tonight, Nick said.
Well, your mum wanted it to be a surprise.
Surprise, Astrid said, fluttering her fingers and giving him an ironic smile. Everyone made their way back to the living room where Nick and Rachel were surrounded by a flurry of dinner guests. Lorena Lim and Carol Tai shook Rachel's hand, while Daisy Fu embraced Nick. It did not escape Rachel that Daisy was the first person who had hugged him all night.
Aya, Nikki, why have you been hiding your beautiful girlfriend for so long? Daisy said, greeting Rachel with an effusive hug as well.
Before Rachel could respond, she felt someone grabbing her arm. She looked down at the Bing cherry-sized ruby ring and long red manicured claws before looking up in shock at a woman with teal-green eyeshadow and rouge painted heavier than a drag queen's.
Rachel, I'm Nadine, the woman said. I've heard so much about you from my daughter.
Really? Who's your daughter? Rachel asked politely. Just then, she heard a high-pitched squeal right behind her.
Nikki, oh, I missed you,
a distinctive voice exclaimed. A chill came over Rachel. It was Francesca Shaw, greeting Nick with a tight bear hug and a kiss on the cheek. Before she could react, Francesca put on her biggest smile and swooped down on Rachel with another double cheek kiss.
Rachel, lovely to see you so soon again.
Oh, were you at Araminta's bachelorette party? Nick asked.
Of course I was. We all had such a glorious time, didn't we, Rachel? Such a beautiful island, and wasn't the food marvelous? I heard you particularly enjoyed the fish course.
Yes, it was quite an experience, Rachel replied slowly, stunned by Francesca's remarks. Was she admitting responsibility for the mutilated fish?
She noticed that Francesca's lipstick had left a bright red imprint on Nick's cheek.
I'm not sure if you remember my cousin Astrid, Nick said to Francesca.
Of course!
Francesca rushed to greet her with a hug. Astrid stiffened up, taken aback by how familiar Francesca was being. Francesca scrutinized Astrid from head to toe. She was wearing a white drape front silk georgette dress with navy blue trim.
The cut is so perfect, it must be couture. But who's the designer?
What a fantastic dress, Francesca said.
Thank you. You look lovely in red, Astrid responded.
Valentino, of course,
Francesca replied, pausing to wait for Astrid to reveal the designer of her outfit. But Astrid did not reciprocate. Without missing a beat, Francesca turned to Nick's mother and gushed.
What a fabulous place, Auntie L. I want to move in right now. It's also Morris Lapidus, so Miami modern. It makes me want to throw on a poochie caftan and order a whiskey sour.
Wow, Francesca, you hit it right on the head, Eleanor said in delight. Everybody, we're going to do something different tonight.
We're all going to makan in my little kitchen, she announced as she led her guests into a kitchen that to Rachel seemed anything but little.
The cavernous space looked like a gourmand's idea of what heaven might be, a gleaming temple of white calicata marble, stainless steel surfaces, and state-of-the-art appliances. A chef in white uniform stood by the commercial-grade Viking stove, busy monitoring bubbling copper pots, while three kitchen maids scurried around making final preparations. At the far end was an alcove with an Art Deco diner-style banquette. As they took their seats, Carol glanced over at the chef deftly ladling crimson broth into large white clay soup bowls.
Wow, Eleanor, I feel like I'm dining at the chef's table of some shishi restaurant, she said.
Isn't it fun? Eleanor said merrily. She looked at Rachel and said,
I was never allowed to set foot in the kitchen at my mother-in-law's house. Now I get to eat in my own kitchen and actually watch the food being cooked.
Rachel smiled in amusement. Here was a woman who obviously had never cooked a meal in her life but seemed to relish the novelty of being inside a kitchen. Well, I love to cook. I can only dream of one day having a kitchen as beautiful as yours, Mrs. Young, Rachel said. Eleanor smiled graciously.
I'm sure you can, with my son's money.
Rachel is an amazing cook,
Without her, I'd probably be eating ramen noodles every night, Nick added.
That would be just like you, Daisy commented. She looked at Rachel and said, I used to call Nicky my noodle boy. He was always so crazy over noodles as a kid. We would take him to the top restaurants in Singapore, and all he ever wanted was a plate of fried noodles with extra gravy.
As she said this, three maids entered the dining alcove and placed large steaming bowls of laksa noodle soup in front of each guest. Rachel marveled at the beautiful composition of butterfly shrimp, fried fish cake, pillowy tofu puffs, and hard-boiled egg halves beautifully arranged over the thick rice vermicelli and fiery soup. For a few minutes, the room lapsed into silence as everyone slurped down the distinctive noodles and savored the rich broth. I can taste the coconut milk in the soup, but what gives it the slightly tart, spicy kick? Is it kefir? Rachel asked.
Show off, Eleanor thought.
Good guess.
It's tamarind, Daisy answered.
This girl wasn't bullshitting. She does know how to cook.
Rachel, it's so impressive that you know your way around a spice rack,
Francesca chirped, her fake friendly tone barely masking her disdain. Apparently not as well as you know how to gut a fish, Rachel commented.
You girls went fishing?
Philip looked up from his laksa in surprise.
Oh, yes, we did. One of the girls even caught a bigger endangered fish. We tried to convince her to put it back in the water, but she wouldn't, and it ended up biting her very hard. There was blood squirting all over the place,
Francesca said, biting the head off her jumbo prawn and spitting it onto the side of the bowl.
Serves her right, La. Our oceans are getting so overfished, and we must respect all of God's creatures, Carol declared. Yes, I agree. You know, when you're just a tourist, you need to learn to respect the environment you're in, Francesca said,
glaring at Rachel for a split second before shifting her gaze onto Astrid.
Now, Astrid, when can I get you to join one of my committees?
What sort of committees? Astrid asked more out of politeness than any real curiosity.
Take your pick. I'm on the boards of the Singapore History Museum, the Museum of Contemporary Arts, the Heritage Society, the Palau Club, the Cultural Arts Advisory Board at SBC, the Steering Committee of Singapore Fashion Week, the Singapore Zoo, the Lee Kong Chian Natural History Museum Selection Committee, the Wine Connoisseur Society, Save the Chatouche, the Junior Committee of Christian Helpers, and of course, the Shaw Foundation.
Well, my 3-year-old boy keeps me pretty busy, Astrid began.
Once he's in kindergarten and you have nothing to do, you really should consider joining one of my charities. I could fast-track you onto a committee. I think you'd be a natural.
So, Rachel, I hear you teach at NYU with Nick.
Lorena cut in. This Francesca is getting on my nerves. We're here to interrogate Rachel, not Astrid.
Yes, I do, Rachel replied. Which department?
Nadine asked, fully knowing the answer, since Eleanor had read the entire dossier on Rachel Chu to all the ladies while they were getting hour-long reflexology massages in Shenzhen.
I'm in the Department of Economics, and I teach at the undergrad level. And how much do you get paid a year?
Nadine inquired. Rachel was dumbstruck.
Yeah, mummy, to Americans, it's very rude to ask how much somebody makes,
Francesca said at last, clearly delighting in seeing Rachel squirm.
Oh, is it? I was just curious to know how much a college teacher in America could possibly earn,
Nadine said in her most innocent tone.
Would you ever consider working in Asia?
Daisy asked. Rachel paused. It seemed like a pretty loaded question, and she figured that the group would dissect whatever answer she gave.
Of course, if the right opportunity came along, she finally replied.
The ladies exchanged furtive looks while Philip slurped on his soup. After dinner, as the group adjourned to the living room for coffee and dessert, Astrid abruptly announced that she had to leave.
Are you okay?
Nick asked.
You seem a little out of sorts tonight.
I'm fine. I just got a text from Evangeline that Cassian is staging a coup and refusing to sleep, so I better dash off.
In reality, Evangeline had informed her that Michael had stopped by and was reading Cassian a bedtime story.
Do not let him leave,
Astrid frantically texted back. Nick and Rachel decided to seize this opportunity to make an exit as well, pleading fatigue from a long day of travel. As soon as the elevator had closed on them, Eleanor announced,
"Did you see the way that girl was staring at everything around the flat? Darling, you've spent a year decorating. Of course people are going to stare. Isn't that the whole point?"
Philip interjected as he helped himself to a large slice of chocolate banana cake.
"Philip, that little economist brain of hers was busy calculating the value of everything. You could see her adding everything up with her big, bulging eyes. And all that talk about cooking for Nick, what rot! As if that's going to impress me, knowing that she puts her rough peasant hands all over his food."
"Well, you're in fine form tonight, darling," Philip said. "Frankly, I found her to be very pleasant, and her features quite nice." He was careful to emphasize the word quite, knowing that his wife would fly into even more of a jealous fit at the thought of another woman in her vicinity being unequivocally proclaimed a beauty.
"I have to agree with Philip. She was really quite pretty. Whether you care to admit it, Eleanor, your son at least has good taste,"
Daisy said as she scrutinized the maid pouring her cafe latte.
"Really? You think she's as pretty as Astrid?" Eleanor asked.
"Astrid is a sultry, tempestuous beauty. This one is totally different. She has a simpler, more placid beauty," Daisy observed.
"But don't you think she's a little flat-chested?" Eleanor said.
Philip sighed. There was just no winning with his wife. "Well, good night, everyone. It's time for my CSI Miami," he said, getting up from the sofa and making a beeline for his media room. Francesca waited for him to round the corner before she spoke.
"Well, I, for one, think you are completely right about this girl, Auntie L. I spent the whole weekend with Rachel, and I saw her true colors. First of all, she picked out the most expensive dresses from the resort boutique when she found out that Araminta was paying. She was wearing one of them tonight.
That plain lilac dress? A la marque! She has no taste!"
Nadine exclaimed. Francesca continued her assault.
"Then she spent all of yesterday taking different classes at the resort. Yoga, Pilates, Nia, you name it. It was as if she was trying to avoid us and get her money's worth at the spa. And you should have heard her at dinner. She boldly announced that she went after Nicky because he is such a catch. Actually, I think her exact words were, 'He's a total catch.'"
"Tisk, tisk, tisk. Can you imagine?"
Nadine said, shuddering openly.
"Lily, what are you going to do now that you've met her?"
Carol asked.
"I think this girl needs to be sent packing. All you have to do is say the word, Auntie L. And as I told you, it would be my pleasure to help,"
Francesca said, giving Eleanor a meaningful look. Eleanor took a few moments to answer, stirring her decaf cappuccino purposefully. She had been in a state of panic for weeks, but now that she had finally met this Rachel Chu, a preternatural calm had settled over her. She could see what needed to be done, and she knew she had to proceed covertly. She had witnessed firsthand the scars that blatant parental interference could inflict. Why, even those assembled here were a reminder of that. Daisy's relationship with her sons was tenuous at best, while Lorena's eldest daughter no longer spoke to her after immigrating to Auckland with her Kiwi husband.
"Thank you, Francesca. You are always so helpful," Eleanor finally said. "For now, I don't think we need to do anything. We should all just sit back and watch because things are about to get interesting."
"You're right, Elle. There's no need to rush into anything. Besides, after Shenzhen, all the cards are in your hand,"
Lorena said gleefully as she scraped away the frosting from her cake.
"What happened in Shenzhen?"
Francesca asked eagerly. Eleanor ignored Francesca's question and smiled.
"I might not even have to play the Shenzhen card. Let's not forget, all the Youngs and the Shangs are about to descend on Singapore for the cool wedding."
"Oh-ho! Who wants to bet she doesn't even last through the weekend?"
Nadine cackled. Part 3. Let China sleep, for when she awakens, she will shake the world. Napoleon Bonaparte. Chapter 1. Tyersall Park.
Singapore.
Colin and I would speed down the slope on our bikes, hands in the air, seeing who could go the farthest without touching the handlebars, Nick said, as they were driven up the long, winding driveway to Tyersall Park. Arriving here with Nick was an entirely different experience for Rachel from her first time with Paik Lin. For starters, Nick's grandmother had sent a gorgeous vintage Daimler to pick them up, and this time Nick was pointing things out along the way.
See that enormous rambutan tree? Colin and I tried to build a treehouse in it. We spent 3 days working in secret, but then Amar found out and was furious. She didn't want anything to ruin her precious rambutan fruit and forced us to dismantle it. Colin was so pissed off, he decided to pluck down as many of the rambutans as he could.
Rachel laughed. You guys got into quite a bit of trouble, didn't you?
Yep. We were always getting into scrapes.
Back then, there were still kampongs, these traditional Malay villages where the native Malays lived as their ancestors had, in wooden huts without electricity or anything. Well, there was a kampong quite near us, and Colin and I would sneak in to steal baby chickens.
Little rascals, where was the adult supervision?
What adult supervision? The car pulled up to the porte cochere, and several servants emerged from a side door to remove their luggage from the trunk. The Indian butler came down the front steps to greet them.
Good afternoon, Mr. Young. Miss Chu? Mrs. Young is expecting you for tea. She's in the Star Fruit Grove.
Thanks, Sanjit. We'll head there now, Nick said. He guided Rachel past the red flagstone terrace and down a graceful allee where white acanthus and colorful bursts of hibiscus mingled with lavish thickets of Egyptian papyrus. These gardens are even more glorious in the daytime, Rachel remarked, running her fingers along the row of papyrus stalks swaying gently in the breeze. Enormous dragonflies buzzed about, their wings sparkling in the sunlight.
Remind me to show you the lily pond. We have these enormous lily pads there. Victoria Amazonica, the largest in the world. You can practically sunbathe on them.
As they approached the grove, a most curious sight awaited Rachel. Nick's 90-something-year-old grandmother stood at the top of a wooden ladder that leaned precariously against the trunk of a tall starfruit tree, painstakingly fussing over some plastic bags. Two gardeners stood at the foot of the rickety ladder, holding it steady, while a Gurkha and the two Thai ladies' maids looked on placidly.
Sweet Jesus, she's gonna fall off that ladder and break her neck, Rachel said in alarm.
This is Amma's thing. There's no stopping her, Nick said with a grin.
But what exactly is she doing?
She inspects every single one of the young star fruits and wraps each of them in their own plastic bags. The humidity helps them to ripen and protects them from birds.
Why doesn't she let one of the gardeners do it?
She loves doing it herself. She does this with her guavas, too.
Rachel stared up at Nick's grandmother, immaculately dressed in a crisply pleated yellow gardening smock, and marveled at her dexterity. Su Yi looked down, noticing that she had a new audience, and said in Mandarin,
1 minute. I just have 2 more to do.
When Nick's grandmother had safely descended the ladder, much to Rachel's relief, the group proceeded down another pathway that led to a formal French-walled garden, where a profusion of African blue lilies were planted amid perfectly manicured boxwood hedges. In the middle of the garden stood a jewel-like conservatory that appeared to have been transported straight out of the English countryside.
This is where Amma cultivates her prize-winning orchid hybrids, Nick informed Rachel.
Wow, was all Rachel could say as she entered the greenhouse. Hundreds of orchid plants hung on different levels throughout the space, their subtle sweetness permeating the air. Rachel had never seen this many varieties, from intricate spider orchids and vividly colored vandas to the magnificent cattleyas and almost indecently suggestive slipper orchids. Tucked in the middle of all this was a round table that appeared to have been carved out of a single block of blue malachite. Its base consisted of 4 majestically fierce griffins facing in different directions, each poised to take flight. As they made themselves comfortable on the cushioned wrought iron chairs, a trio of servers appeared as if on cue, bearing an enormous 5-tiered silver tray laden with delectable nonya kues, finger sandwiches, gem-like pâté de fruits, and fluffy golden brown scones. A tea cart was rolled toward them by one of the Thai lady's maids, and Rachel felt like she was hallucinating as she watched the maiden delicately pouring freshly steeped tea from a teapot intricately carved with multicolored dragons. She had never seen a more sumptuous tea service in her life. "Here are my grandmother's famous scones. Dig in," Nick said gleefully, licking his lips. The scones were still warm as Rachel broke one apart and slathered it with a generous helping of clotted cream, just as she'd learned from Nick. She was about to put some of the strawberry jam onto the scone when Su Yi said in Mandarin, "You should try it with some of the lemon curd. My cook makes it fresh every day." Rachel didn't feel like she was in a position to defy her hostess, so she scooped on some lemon curd and took her first bite. It was pure heaven, the buttery lightness of the pastry combined with the decadent cream and the smooth hint of sweet lemon made for a perfect alchemy of flavors. Rachel sighed audibly. "You were right, Nick. This is the best scone on the planet." Nick grinned triumphantly. "Mrs. Young, I'm still discovering the history of Singapore. Was afternoon tea always a custom in your family?" Rachel asked. "Well, I am not a native Singaporean. I spent my childhood in Peking, and we, of course, did not follow the British custom there. It was only when my family moved here that we picked it up, these colonial habits. It was something we first did for our British guests because they didn't much appreciate Chinese cooking. Then when I married Nick's grandfather, who had spent many years abroad in England, he insisted on a proper afternoon tea with all the trimmings. And of course, the children loved it. I suppose that's how I got used to it," Su Yi replied in her slow, deliberate way. It was only then Rachel realized that Nick's grandmother had not touched any of the scones or finger sandwiches. Instead, she ate only a piece of Nonya Kueh with her tea. "Tell me, is it true that you are a professor of economics?" Su Yi asked. "It is," Rachel replied. "It is good that you had the opportunity to learn such things in America. My father was a businessman, but he never wanted me to learn about financial matters. He always said that within 100 years, China would become the most powerful nation the world has ever seen, and that is something I always repeated to my children and grandchildren. Isn't that right, Nikki?" "Yes, Amma. That's why you made me learn my Mandarin," Nick confirmed. He could already see where this conversation was headed. "Well, I was right in doing that, wasn't I? I am fortunate enough to see my father's foresight come true in my lifetime. Rachel, did you watch the Beijing Olympics opening ceremony?" "I did." "Did you see how magnificent it was? No one in the world can doubt China's might after the Olympics." "No, they really can't," Rachel replied. "The future is in Asia. Nick's place is here, don't you think?" Nick knew Rachel was headed straight into an ambush and interrupted her before she could answer. "I've always said that I would return to Asia, Amma, but right now I am still gaining valuable experience in New York." "You said the same thing 6 years ago when you wanted to remain in England after your studies. And now you're in America. What's next, Australia, like your father? It was a mistake to send you abroad in the first place. You have become far too seduced by Western ways." Rachel couldn't help noting the irony in what Nick's grandmother was saying. She looked and sounded like a Chinese woman in the most traditional sense, and yet here they were in a walled garden straight out of the Loire Valley having English afternoon tea. Nick didn't know how to respond. This was a debate he had been having with his grandmother for the past few years, and he knew he would never win. He started to pick apart the colored layers in a piece of Nonya Kueh, thinking he should excuse himself for a moment. It would be good for Rachel to have some private time with his grandmother. He glanced at his watch and said, "Amma, I think Auntie Alex and family will be arriving from Hong Kong any minute now. Why don't I go welcome them and bring them here?" His grandmother nodded. Nick smiled at Rachel, giving her a look of assurance before stepping out of the conservatory. Suyi tilted her head to the left slightly, and one of the Thai lady's maids immediately sprang to her side, bending in one graceful motion onto her knees so that her ear was level with Suyi's mouth.
"Tell the conservatory gardener that it needs to be 5 degrees warmer in here," Suyi said in English.
She turned her attention back to Rachel.
"Tell me, where are your people from?"
There was a forcefulness in her voice that Rachel had not previously noticed.
"My mother's family came from Guangdong. My father's family..."
"I never knew," Rachel answered nervously.
"How come?"
"He died before I was born, and then I came to America as an infant with my mother."
"And did your mother remarry?"
"No, she never did."
Rachel could feel the Thai lady's maid staring in silent judgment.
"So, do you support your mother?"
"No, quite the contrary. She put herself through college in America and is now a real estate agent. She's done well for herself and was even able to support me through my university studies," Rachel responded.
Suyi was silent for a while, considering the girl before her. Rachel didn't dare to move at all. Finally, Suyi spoke.
"Did you know that I had quite a few brothers and sisters? My father had many concubines who bore him children, but only one supreme wife, my mother. She bore him 6 children, but out of all my siblings, only 3 were officially accepted, myself and 2 of my brothers."
"Why only the 3 of you?" Rachel ventured to ask.
"You see, my father believed he had a gift. He felt that he was able to ascertain a person's entire future based on their faces, the way they looked, and he chose to keep only the children he felt would go on to please him. He chose my husband for me this way as well. Did you know that?"
He said,
"This man has a good face. He will never make any money, but he will never hurt you. He was right on both counts."
Nick's grandmother leaned in closer to Rachel and stared straight into her eyes.
"I see your face," she said in a hushed tone.
Before Rachel could ask what she meant, Nick approached the conservatory door with a cluster of guests. The door burst open, and a man in a white linen shirt and bright orange linen pants bounded toward Nick's grandmother.
"Amma, dearest Amma, how I've missed you," the man said dramatically in Cantonese, dropping to his knees and kissing her hands.
"Aiya, Eddie, Sa Si Lang, stop bothering me to death," Suyi scolded, withdrawing her hands and smacking him across the head.
Chapter 2. 11 Nassim Road, Singapore. God is in the details. Mies van der Rohe's iconic quote was the mantra Annabelle Lee lived by. From the sculpted mango popsicles handed out to guests lounging by the pool to the precise placement of a camellia blossom on every eiderdown pillow, Annabelle's unerring eye for detail was what made her chain of luxury hotels the favored choice for the most discriminating travelers. Tonight, the object of scrutiny was her own reflection. She was wearing a high-collared, champagne-colored dress woven from Irish linen and trying to decide whether to layer it with a double strand of Baroque pearls or an opera-length amber necklace. Were the Nakamura pearls too ostentatious? Would the amber beads be subtler? Her husband, Peter, entered her boudoir wearing dark gray slacks and a pale blue shirt.
"Are you sure you want me to wear this? I look like an accountant," he said, thinking his butler had surely made a mistake in laying out these clothes.
"You look perfect. I ordered the shirt specifically for tonight's occasion. It's Eden Ravenscroft. They make all of the Duke of Edinburgh's shirts. Trust me, it's better to be underdressed with this crowd," Annabelle said, giving him a careful once-over.
Although there were grand events every single night of the week in the ramp-up to Araminta's wedding,
The party that Harry Leung was throwing tonight in honor of his nephew Colin Koo at the fabled Leung residence on Nassim Road was the one Annabelle was secretly most eager to attend. When Peter Lee, originally Lee Peitan of Harbin, made his first fortune in Chinese coal mining during the mid-90s, he and his wife decided to move their family to Singapore, like many of the newly minted mainlanders were doing. Peter wanted to maximize the benefits of being based in the region's preferred wealth management center, and Annabelle, originally Anne Louis Bao of Urumqi, wanted their young daughter to benefit from Singapore's more westernized, and in her eyes, superior, education system. The superior air quality didn't hurt either. Besides, she had tired of the Beijing elite, of all the interminable 12-course banquets in rooms filled with bad replicas of Louis Gator's furniture, and she longed to reinvent herself on a more sophisticated island where the ladies understood Armani and spoke perfect accentless English. She wanted Araminta to grow up speaking perfect accentless English. But in Singapore, Annabelle soon discovered that beyond the bold-faced names that eagerly invited her to all the glamorous galas, there hid a whole other level of society that was impervious to the flash of money, especially mainland Chinese money. These people were snobbier and more impenetrable than anything she had ever encountered.
Who cares about those old mothball families? They're just jealous that we're richer and that we really know how to enjoy ourselves, her new friend Trina Tua, wife of the TLS private equity chairman Tua Lao Sai, said. Annabelle knew this was something Trina said to console herself, that she would never be invited to Mrs. Lee Yongqian's legendary mahjong parties, where the women bet with serious jewelry, or get to peek behind the tall gates of the magnificent modernist house that architect Ki Yip had designed for Rosemary Tian on Dalvey Road. Tonight, she was finally going to be invited in, even though she maintained homes in New York, London, Shanghai, and Bali, and even though Architectural Digest called her Edward Tuttle-designed house in Singapore one of the most spectacular private residences in Asia, Annabelle's heartbeat quickened as she passed through the austere wooden gates of 11 Nassim Road. She had long admired the house from afar. Colonial black-and-white houses like these were an architectural style found nowhere else in the world. Combining Anglo-Indian features with English arts and craft style, these white-painted bungalows with black trim detailing were ingeniously designed for the tropical climate and exceedingly rare these days. This one, which had been continuously occupied by the Leung family since the 20s, was perhaps the only one left on the island to retain all of its original features. Entering through the carved wooden front doors, Annabelle quickly soaked in every minute detail of the way these people lived. Look at this whole row of Malay servants flanking the entrance hall in crisp white blazers. What are they offering on these Selangor pewter trays? Pim's number one with fizzy pineapple juice and fresh mint leaves. How quaint. I must copy that for the new Sri Lanka resort. Ah, here is Felicity Leung in tailored silk jacquard, wearing the most exquisite piece of lilac jade, and her daughter-in-law, Kathleen, the constitutional law expert. This girl is always so plain, with not a drop of jewelry in sight. You would never guess she's married to the eldest Leung son. And here is Astrid Leung. What was it like for her to grow up in this house? No wonder she has such great taste. That robin's egg blue dress she's wearing is on the cover of French Vogue this month. Who's this man whispering to Astrid at the foot of the stairs? Oh, it's her husband, Michael. What a stunning couple they make. And look at this drawing room. Oh, just look. The symmetry, the scale, the profusion of orange blossoms. Sublime. I need orange blossoms in all the hotel lobbies next week. Wait a second. Is that Ruware from the Northern Song Dynasty? Yes, it is. 1, 2, 3, 4. There are so many pieces. Unbelievable. This room alone must have $30 million worth of ceramics, strewn about as if they were cheap ashtrays.
And these Peranakin-style opium chairs. Look at the mother-of-pearl inlay. I've never seen a pair in such perfect condition. Here come the Changs of Hong Kong. Look how adorable those children are, all dressed up like little Ralph Lauren models. Never had Annabelle felt more content than right now, when at last she was breathing in this rarefied air. The house was filling up with the sort of aristocratic family she had only heard about over the years, families that could trace their lineage back 30 generations or more, like the Youngs who had just arrived.
Oh, look, Eleanor just waved at me. She's the only one who socializes outside the family. And here's her son, Nicholas, another looker. Colin's best friend. And the girl holding Nicholas's hand must be that Rachel Chu everyone is talking about, the one that's not one of the Taiwan Chus. One look and I could have told you that. This girl grew up drinking vitamin D calcium-fortified American milk. But she still doesn't have a chance of catching Nicholas. And here comes Araminta with all the coups, looking like she belongs.
Annabelle knew at that moment she had made all the right decisions for her daughter, enrolling her at Far Eastern Kindergarten, choosing Methodist Girls' School over Singapore American School, forcing her to go to youth fellowship at First Methodist even though they were Buddhists, and whisking her away to Cheltenham Ladies' College in England for proper finishing. Her daughter had grown up as one of these people, people of breeding and taste. There wasn't a single diamond over 15 carats in this crowd, not a single Louis Vuitton anything, no one looking over your shoulder for bigger fish. This was a family gathering, not a networking opportunity. These people were so completely at ease, so well-mannered. Outside on the East Terrace, Astrid hid behind the dense row of Italian cypresses, waiting for Michael to arrive at her parents' house. As soon as she caught sight of him, she rushed to the front door to meet him so that it would appear they had arrived together. After the initial flurry of greetings, Michael was able to corner her by the staircase.
"Is Cassian upstairs?" he mumbled under his breath.
"No, he isn't," Astrid said quickly before being swept into an embrace by her cousin, Cecilia Chang.
"Where is he? You've been hiding him from me all week," Michael pressed on. "You'll see him soon enough," Astrid whispered as she beamed at her great-aunt Rosemary. "This was your way of tricking me into coming tonight, wasn't it?" Michael said angrily.
Astrid took Michael by the hand and led him into the front parlor next to the staircase.
"Michael, I promised you would see Cassian tonight. Just be patient and let's get through dinner."
"That wasn't the deal. I'm leaving."
"Michael, you can't leave. We still have to coordinate plans for the wedding on Saturday. Auntie Alex is hosting a breakfast before the church ceremony and, Astrid, I'm not going to the wedding."
"Oh, come on, don't choke like this. Everyone is going."
"By everyone, I suppose you are referring to everyone with $1 billion or more," Michael seethed.
Astrid rolled her eyes.
"Come on, Michael, I know we've had a disagreement, and I know you're probably feeling ashamed, but as I said before, I forgive you. Let's not make a huge issue out of this. Come home."
"You don't get it, do you? I'm not coming home. I'm not going to the wedding."
"But what are people going to say if you don't show up at the wedding?"
Astrid looked at him nervously.
"Astrid, I am not the groom. I'm not even related to the groom. Who's going to give a shit whether I'm there or not?"
"You can't do this to me. Everyone will notice and everyone will talk," Astrid pleaded, trying not to panic.
"Tell them I had to fly off at the last minute for work."
"Where are you going? Are you flying off to Hong Kong to see your mistress?" Astrid asked accusingly.
Michael paused a moment. He never wanted to resort to this, but he felt that he had been left with little choice.
"If it makes you feel better to know, yes, I'm off to see my mistress. I'm leaving on Friday after work just so I can get away from this carnival. I can't watch these people spend $1 gazillion on a wedding when half the world is starving."
Astrid stared at him numbly, reeling from what he had said. At that moment, Kathleen, the wife of her brother Henry, walked into the room.
"Oh, thank God you're here," Kathleen said to Michael. "The cooks are having a fit because some transformer blew and that damn high-tech commercial oven we put in last year won't work. Apparently it's gone into self-cleaning mode and there are 4 pecking ducks roasting in there.
Michael glared at his sister-in-law. Kathleen, I have a master's degree from Caltech, specializing in encryption technology.
I'm not your fucking handyman, he fumed, before storming out of the room.
Kathleen stared after him in disbelief.
What's wrong with Michael? I've never seen him like this.
Oh, don't mind him, Kathleen, Astrid said, attempting a weak laugh. Michael's upset because he just found out that he has to rush off to Hong Kong for some work.